Anyway, I see a lot of people from my own program, and I thought I warned everyone that they're not going to learn anything new, but apparently they believe in the digestive properties of the three-dimensional Ising model. There's no experimental evidence to that. So the three-dimensional Ising model, as I'm sure everyone remembers, it's a lattice model. So you take a lattice, and you can do it in an arbitrary number of dimensions, in one, two, or three dimensions. Today I'm mostly going to be doing it in three dimensions. And you put at every lattice side a variable, let's call it a spin, and it takes values plus or minus one. And then you write an energy functional which includes interactions, pairwise interactions between spins, a size j, ferromagnetic interactions, taken over nearby spins, so I and j, which are nearest neighbors. And then you consider, so it's a statistical mechanical model, so you consider a partition function at a given temperature, so summing over all spin configurations. And you can compute correlation functions and other things. So why are we interested in this model? Well, we are interested in it because it's a model, it's the simplest model for ferromagnetism. So, as I'm sure everyone remembers, in this model there are two phases. There is a high temperature phase, so if the temperature is above a certain critical temperature, the expectation value of magnetization of spin is zero. And then if you go to low temperature, then the spin acquires spontaneous magnetization. So it's exactly what happens in ferromagnets. Okay, so it's a model for ferromagnetism, but now the question that I would like to ask is whether this is just a model, this is just a qualitative model, or is there a sense in which this very simple-minded model can actually be quantitatively correct, right? Because there are lots of ferromagnets in nature, and of course, if you look at the crystal lattice and if you look at the physics which happens at the lattice spacing scale, this physics is much, much more complicated than what this simple model does. So how can this model be quantitatively correct? Of course, it cannot be quantitatively correct. It's only qualitatively correct, right? But actually, that's not the full story. No, it's classical statistical mechanics. Yeah, so there is quantum mechanics also that you may think definitely plays a role at the lattice spacing scale, which we are ignoring. So how can this be quantitatively correct? Of course, it's not. But the full story is more interesting. So what happens if you look at the generic temperature, so generic T, then this model is only qualitatively correct. But if you go to temperatures which are very close to the critical temperature, the Curie temperature, then this model actually is quantitatively correct. Becomes quantitatively correct. And so it describes, it's not just a model, but actually describes exactly the physics of all infinitely many uniaxial ferromagnets that exist in nature, and it describes also the physics of liquid-vapor transitions and so on, and much more. So, and of course, why does this happen? And there are many reasons that can be given for this quantitative correctness, but the reason that I would like to focus on now is that the reason why this happens is that the phase transition, which happens for t equals tc, is a second order phase transition. It's a second order phase transition. And one characteristic of second order phase transitions is that the correlation length, so there is a parameter which characterizes a second order phase transition, which is the correlation length, let's call it c. So c is correlation length. So this correlation length can be introduced by looking at a spin-spin correlation function. So let's take a spin-spin correlation function at the distance r. And then if you look at long distances, then this spin-spin correlation function decays exponentially fast. So it goes like e to the minus r over c for r much larger than c. And so this correlation length goes to infinity in the limit when you approach the critical temperature. So c goes to infinity when t goes to tc. And this fact explains the universality of the three-dimensional Ising model. Because since, so there are two distance scales here. There is a distance scale, microscopic distance scale, which is the lattice spacing. And we see the emergence of the macroscopic distance scale of this correlation length, which is much, much larger than the lattice spacing. And so it's natural to expect that in this limit, and only in this limit, when xi is much larger than a, all microscopic details will go away. And in this limit, there is a chance that this lattice, this simple lattice model, can actually be quantitatively correct. Right, so this is the origin of the phenomenon of universality. And of course, the phenomenon of universality has always attracted physicists. So that's the most interesting phenomenon in physics. A universal phenomena, when the same equation describes ferromagnets and boiling water. This is, of course, very, very interesting and has to be understood. And so this phenomenon, it raises immediately several questions. So let me write them. So the questions are, so what exactly is universal? What is universal? Why universal? So I already gave you a very rough explanation or hope for the emergence of universality, but clearly this is not the whole story. So why universality? And what is the most appropriate language to describe this universality? So these are the three questions that one can ask. And you see, this phenomenon of universality, of course, is much more general than this three-dimensional Ising model. There are lots and lots of similar phenomena in statistical mechanics. But if we understand this example, then we can hope to understand all the rest. So let me remind you about the first question first. So what is universal? And the answer to this question, or the most classical answer to this question, is the notion of critical exponents. So there are lots and lots of critical exponents. It's really a zoo, and they're all called various Greek letters. But here, for this talk, I'm going to introduce only two critical exponents, the main critical exponents of the three-dimensional Ising model. So the first one tells you, so I told you that at the second order phase transition, correlation length goes to infinity. So how fast does it go to infinity? It goes like 1 over distance from the critical temperature to some power nu. R nu is called the critical exponent. So that's the first critical exponent. And the second critical exponent, I is related to this 2-2 spin-spin correlation function, SS. So as I told you, that at large distances, it goes exponentially, it becomes exponentially small. But if you look at small distances, well, small, at distances which are much smaller than the correlation length, but much larger than the cutoff scale, than the lattice spacing scale A, then at these distances, it goes like 1 over r to the power d minus 2 plus eta. And this d is, okay, d is equal to 3 for us almost all the time today. And this eta is called also a critical exponent. So,
but what the parameters, okay, it has dimensional length, right?
Yeah.
What is the length? Because you have only, say, temperature and critical temperature, so is this dimensionless ratio of them?
You can write it like this. Xi, more correctly, you should write that Xi over A is goes like 1 over 1 minus T over Tc to the power
unit. Okay. So A is a...
Yeah, of course, everything is measured in the units of A. So you see, if you look at this formula, then you can, okay, this is the simplest critical exponent, but you can already understand that this answer to the question, what is universal, is more general than this formula. So in fact, what happens is that all correlation functions of this lattice model at distances much larger than the lattice spacing, they become universal. So not just this two-point function, but all correlation functions, three-point functions, and so on, they become universal. And corrections to this universal behavior are going to be suppressed by the powers of A over Xi. So corrections to universality are suppressed by A over Xi to some power. And so it's interesting to know how large can this ratio be. And in experiments that people make, this ratio can be really, really huge. So for example, in experiments that people can make with liquid helium, okay, liquid helium is described not by the Ising model, by a cousin of the Ising model where the spin has not one component, but two components. So in the liquid helium, this ratio can be of the order of 10 to the 5. So you can make a correlation length 10 to the 5 times the distance between the helium atoms. And in more ordinary substances like ferromagnets or liquid vapor transitions, this ratio can be as large as 10 to the 4. 10 to the 4. It's 10 to the 4, 10 to the, minus 5, 10 to the 5.
Question?
Yeah.
You gave two different formulas for correlations. Is there a single formula that includes the crossover between two regimes?
Yeah, there should be, and it's also universal.
I see.
Yeah.
So that's known.
No, that's not known. In the three-dimensional case, it's not known. So, so that's the answer to the first question, what is expected to be universal? And now, coming to the second question, so why universal? So here, the main insight, the final insight to this question was provided by the theory of the randomization group. So it's RG. And it's mostly associated with the name of Wilson in the 70s. So the key insight here is this notion of the flow in the space of energy functions. So let me remind you how it works. So you start with the Ising model. Let me go back over here. So you start with the Ising model, which is described on such lattice. And then you do a block spin transformation. So what it means is that you take a group of spins and you unite them. So you take these groups of spins united like this. And then, so this introduces, so once you average over these spins, this introduces new effective variables. Let me call them S tilde. And then So you're passing from this energy functional E, which depends on the configurations of original spins, to a new functional, let me call it E tilde, which depends on S tilde. And the key point is that you should arrange this transformation in such a way that the long distance physics remains undisturbed, so that it remains the same. So
it was normalized. I mean, original S is what value was taken.
It was taken just plus or minus one.
Okay, but this still would be not plus or minus one. Or
it could be only plus or minus three, provided that you arrange this energy functional appropriately, right? So I mean, it's not totally clear that this can be done, but if you think about it, you realize that it can be done, provided that you are forced to turn on new couplings in the theory. So here, in the original functional, I was assuming that only nearby spins were coupled to each other. But if you start doing this kind of transformation, then you realize that you, for example, this spin was coupled both to this and to this spin. So if you're passing to block spins, then surely it will generate also off-diagonal coupling. And so you're going to generate, if you do a sequence of these transformations, you're going to generate a huge number of new couplings. So off-diagonal couplings, but also couplings which involve multiple spin interactions, not just two spin interactions, but four spin interactions, and so on. So you create this huge number of couplings. So in general, huge number of couplings. Number. So this looks like the problem becomes very complicated. It does become very complicated, except in the two cases. So if you are if you're at temperatures higher than the critical temperature, but quite a bit higher, let's say factor two higher than the critical temperature, then what happens is that, or if you are lower than critical temperature, but quite a bit lower, then all these couplings that you generate, additional couplings, can be ignored. So in this case, it turns out that you can work in an approximation when there is just one nearest neighbor coupling in the game. And so what happens is that if you study this coupling, what happens is that in one case, namely if you are below the critical temperature, this coupling becomes stronger and stronger. And so as you do this transformation, your spins, they tend to become more and more aligned with each other. And so in the end, when you did this several transformations of this type, you see that your spins, which were initially maybe not particularly correlated, they become more and more correlated, and you generate an average value of spin. While if you are at above the critical temperature, then the same transformation makes the couplings weaker and weaker, so that at the end of the day, you end up with a completely decorrelated system of spins, and the average spin is going to be zero. So that's how you understand these two regimes in the language organization group. But if you are at temperatures of the order of the critical temperature, this approximation doesn't work. So it can be described in terms of just one coupling. And that's good. That's good because, as I told you, there is this feeling that there is a universal behavior going on. And of course, this universal behavior, it should be much more complicated than just very simple model that we wrote, right? So what usually people draw in this case, they draw this kind of picture. So you have this randomization group flow. So if you are at temperature above the critical temperature, then you flow to the high temperature regime. Then you flow at temperatures below critical temperature, you flow to the low temperature regime. But then if you are precisely at the temperature equal to the critical temperature, then you are going to end up in this fixed point. And this fixed point Hamiltonian, fixed point energy functional, which has the property that it doesn't change at all under this transformation. Right? So this is the fixed point. Now, so this fixed point Hamiltonian, fixed point energy functional, it's going to be incredibly complicated. So it's going to include infinitely many couplings of all possible types, and it can only be found by some sort of truncation. So you have to decide, well, I'm going to assume that couplings of certain type are important, others non-important. Let me do this transformation and truncate every time to this set of couplings. And that's what Wilson actually did numerically. And he showed that, yes, this fixed point Hamiltonian indeed emerges. It's very complicated, but it emerges. And one thing that Wilson showed, and it's going to be important for what I'm going to say later on, is that even though it's incredibly complicated, he noticed that there is a certain hierarchy. Namely, that you start, so we start here with an energy functional which is local, which is very, very local in the sense that it only couples spin, neighboring spins. Now, you start doing this randomization group transformation, you might expect naively that as you do many, many of these transformations, you will discover couplings which extend over very, very long ranges in this lattice. But that's not what happens. What happens is that indeed you generate couplings which extend far, but this extension decays very rapidly with distance. So the claim is that this fixed point energy functional, which by the way is not known, so it's not known what this functional is, but we think it exists, and this functional, this energy functional, is sufficiently local. So it's not fully local, but it's not also not totally unlocal. It's sufficiently local. And this is going to be, so this empirical fact, which comes out of numerical experiments, is going to be important for what I'm going to say later on. Right? So that was a crucial insight of Wilson. And now another crucial insight of Wilson was that he found a way to organize all these infinitely many couplings. So you have infinitely many couplings, and they all transform in some complicated way under this transformation. So how should you organize them? Well, he said the way you should think about it is that you should expand your functional around the fixed point functional, and then you should group all the various couplings into groups in such a way that in each group, the couplings are going to transform multiplicatively by the same factor. So what it means is that you should look for the eigenvalues of this transformation. So you should group the couplings into eigenfunctions of this transformation, and you should look for their corresponding eigenvalues. And if you do this, you realize that empirically, what happens is that most of these eigenvalues are going to be negative. So most of the combinations of the couplings under this transformation are driven to zero. And that's why. So this phenomenon is the explanation of universality. Because if you have infinitely many couplings that you can turn on, but most of the combination, most of these couplings, when viewed as particular linear combinations, they are driven to zero, apart from one particular combination. In this case, there's just one combination, which is going to have a positive eigenvalue, and it's going to be amplified. And this combination, if you want to reach the critical point, it has to be tuned to zero. So this the existence of one such combination exactly means that there should be an experimentalist who fine-tunes the knob, if you want to reach the critical point. Right. So let me then sum up what I just said. So these critical exponents that I introduced, like here, this exponent eta, they turn out to be related. They should be thought of as eigenvalues of this particular transformation. And the fields, so this field, like the this field S that I introduced, and there are going to be more fields, more operators, they should be thought of as the eigen, as the eigenvectors of this transformation. So what we are dealing with here is some incredibly complicated linear algebra problem. So just like you, you have to diagonalize a certain incredibly complicated matrix. So this picture is incredibly useful conceptually, but not only conceptually, because using this technique, you can actually approximately evaluate these critical exponents in your own data, and people did this. Right? But this is not an easy computation because, as I said, there are lots and lots of couplings you have to truncate, and there is no clear way, there is no kind of hierarchy how to truncate. So it seems to be a lot of arbitrariness in the game, and even though people played with it a lot, there seems to be that this technique is mostly good for like conceptual understanding, but not so good to make actual computations. Right. But it's going to be useful for what I'm going to say next. So you see, what we need here is some sort of continuum approach. So now we are coming to the third question. So what language should we use to describe this critical point behavior? So we need some sort of continuum approach. The lattice, it's silly to get, you know, to tie yourself up to the lattice, because we just discussed that lattice is completely non-universal. Everything disappears in the long range, in the long distance limit. So we should have an approach which works directly in the continuum. And so let me tell you one such approach which will connect to something that everyone has seen again. You know, the first thing which comes to mind when you want to do a continuum approach, you say, well, I'm going to do field theory. So in the long distance limit, my spin field, after doing several such transformations, is going to become smoothed out. So instead of talking about lattice, what I can talk about a continuum limit. So I'm going to introduce some kind of spin field S of X. And I'm going to write down some action, some Lagrangian for this field. And the first thing that comes to mind that you can write is an action of the form, I'm going to introduce some kinetic energy, potential energy, but the one which depends on the gradient, and I'm going to introduce some potential. So there's going to be a quadratic part, and there's going to be a quartic part in the potential, and I'm going to integrate. Right? So this is going to be my continuum limit. And this approach, as everyone surely remembers, is associated with the name of Landau. And this approach is very, very good in, again, understanding the gross features of this critical behavior. Because you, what you understand from this approach is that if you have, if this parameter mu squared is positive, then you have, your potential has a unique minimum. And so this corresponds to being above critical temperature. If this parameter mu squared is negative, then your potential has two minima, and this corresponds to being below critical temperature. And then in order to get to the critical point, you would say, well, I just have to fine tune, I have just have to consider the case where this parameter is zero. So why can't I study the critical point using this field theory? Well, it's an interesting question, and the answer is the following. So this method fails, well, in a certain technical sense, precisely near the critical point. And the reason is the following. So if you have a potential like this, or if you have a potential like this, then the field S of X is going to have certain fluctuations around its minimum, like here and here. And these fluctuations are going to be bounded you know, the size of these fluctuations is going to be bounded precisely by the curvature of the potential near the minimum. But if you go to this situation where the mass term is zero, so the mass, these fluctuations become much larger. Because instead of quadratic term, you have a much more shallow potential, only quartic potential, and so you have huge fluctuations of this order parameter S of X. So huge fluctuations. And so this is a, okay, intuitively it's clear that the fluctuations become large, but what happens technically is that this field theory becomes strongly coupled. So what does this mean? It means that if you try to apply perturbation theory to compute in this field theory, like doing Feynman diagrams and so on, then you discover that this perturbative series diverges. And it's not like in quantum electrodynamics where we know that the asymptotic series is asymptotic, but it's going to start diverging after 100 terms. And so in practice, it never matters. So here, it starts diverging basically from the second or third term. You start seeing that the answers that you get out of your field theory computation become basically senseless. So what do you do with this? There are two lines of attack. One line which met with some success is that sometimes in quantum field theory it happens, and we discussed at this conference some examples, that even divergent series can be made sense out of. You know, there are some resummation techniques which can you can try to resum a divergent series and get some finite answer out of this. And this sounds crazy, but in fact, in certain cases, it works. It works, but it still leaves an unpleasant taste in the mouth, because why should we do this mumbo jumbo for something as beautiful as as universal? And also on the practical level, it's not particularly good, because even though the series is convergent, once you resum it, it's convergent very, very slowly. So even after you compute millions of Feynman diagrams, you still get very modest numerical improvement. But there are some people who are thinking about this line of attack. It's not yet, the jury is still out. But here I'm going to discuss, so that, and now finally I'm coming to the subject of my talk, the core of my talk. I'm going to talk about a different line of attack. And so this line of attack that I'm going to discuss, it tries to go to the source of the problem. So what is the source of the problem here? In both approaches, in the approach which was based on the lattice and on the real, on this lattice renormalization group, and the approach which is based on this kind of field theory computations. The approach is that we are trying to extract this kind of long distance behavior in terms of some degrees of freedom which live at short distances. So this field S here, which appears in this Lagrangian, is not the same field which appears here at long distances. It's some complicated function of it, but it's not exactly the same field. In the language of quantum field theory, it's a renormalized field. In the same thing with lattice. On lattice, you have some discrete degrees of freedom, and once you pass to this, you have to average them in some complicated way, and so on. So these are not, so the language, the right language that I would argue for this problem would be the right choice of variables would be to focus directly on these quantities we are interested in, on these long distance fields. So is there a better choice? So So is there a better choice? So let me now tell you what this better choice is. So in this language that I'm going to propose now, I'm going to be operating directly with these long distance fields which have well-defined critical exponents. So what I mean is the following. Remember, when I was talking about randomization group, I said that those fields are associated with some sort of eigenfunctions of this randomization group transformation. And when you do randomization group analysis, you have to extract these eigenfunctions. What I'm going to say instead is that, okay, suppose that somebody already extracted those eigenfunctions for me. There are going to be a certain set of fields with well-defined eigenvalues, and let me just focus on those. So I don't wanna ask about their microscopic origin. I'm just going to work with those fields. So let me assume that there is a bunch of fields. Let me call them AI of X. And these are fields with well-defined scaling dimensions. So fields with well-defined I didn't introduce this term before, scaling dimension, but let me do it now, scaling dimensions. So what it means is that if I take a two-point function, ai of x, aj of 0, then this two-point function is going to be equal to some constant times delta ij divided by x to the power 2 delta I. So let me explain. This randomization group transformation was rescaling distances, right? So I was telling you that the eigenvalues were these critical exponents. And here I'm just packaging this eigenvalue into this number delta I, which appears here, which just tells me how the two-point function of this field A rescales under the change of x. So it's clear that delta I is associated with AI. Yeah, so it's called the scaling dimension of the field AI. So you should think of AI as the eigenvector, delta I as this corresponding eigenvalue, and the fact that the two-point functions of the two fields are non-zero, are zero of two different fields, are zero, it just means it's a sort of a version of the fact that different eigenfunctions are orthogonal.
Okay, but an eigenfunction of what operator?
Of this randomization, linearized randomization group transformation. Yeah.
Derotation.
Yeah, or in the continuum language with derotation. But I want to keep this connection with the randomization group, right? So, and I'm going to set this constant to 1 because it's just a choice of normalization. So that's the first thing. Now, I'm going to do, so this is the two-point function, but I'm also interested in more complicated correlation functions. So for example, if I study several operators, a and of xn. So what am I going to tell about those? So now I'm going to make a more radical assumption, which can be justified as follows. Suppose that I take two operators, a1 inserted at the point x and a2 inserted at the point 0. So, and I'm going to think about these two operators in the following way. So this, the fact that I have many, many different fields or operators, I use this two names interchangeably, it just means kind of physically that my medium, this critical state, it has lots and lots of different ways of fluctuate. There are different types of fluctuation. There's not just one type, but many, many different types. And just like an aircraft has different modes of oscillation, it's interesting to study here all different types of oscillation. Now, if I insert, but now here comes the difference from the aircraft, is that if I insert two operators next to each other, then it's like I'm exciting two different modes of oscillation. But now, so in an aircraft, these modes of oscillation, they are all roughly, it's to a very high extent a linear system, so they don't interact with each other. But here in this critical physics, the system is nonlinear, and so when you excite it with two different modes, you can actually expand this excitation. So the basis of modes is complete. So we hit the system with two different modes, and now we can expand its fluctuation into linear combination of the same modes, of the same infinitely many modes. So I'm going to claim that, or take as an assumption, that the product of two operators at two nearby points can be expanded into an infinite sum with some coefficients f, I, j, k, operators a, k at the origin. Well, I could actually choose another point. And now there's going to be a dependence on x, and this dependence can be fixed just by knowing how every operator rescales. So you see this formula, it tells you how the operator rescales when I do the transformation x going to lambda x. And so by using this scaling properties, I know that the coefficient here is going to be, okay, let me write IAJ, is going to be x to the power delta I plus delta j minus delta k. And this is called operator algebra. This is already a non-trivial assumption which does not follow from the randomization group theory. And so it needs a separate justification, and let's just take it for granted and see how much we can get out of it. I can't in this talk, don't have time to justify it more reasonably. And now, if I take this assumption, I can use it. So what's the practical meaning of this assumption? Is that I can now take, say, a three-point function, ai of x, aj of y, and ak of z, and I can compute it using this algebra. Because I take these two points, I take these two operators, and I use the algebra for these two operators. So I'm going to get Fijk divided by x minus y to the power delta I plus delta j minus delta k times operator ak inserted at y. And now I take the two-point function of this operator ak with the other operator ak, and so I'm going to get 1 divided by y minus z to the power 2 delta k, right? So if this algebra is true, I get a prediction for the three-point function, right? Right? Except that, of course, this prediction doesn't make any sense because this prediction clearly depends on the choice of the choice that I chose the algebra to do the algebra for these two operators and not for these two operators, because here I have x minus delta y, so I have a very simple dependence on x, y, and z, and this dependence is not symmetric with respect to the choice of the pair of the operators. So clearly this formula cannot make sense. So where's our mistake? And the mistake is that, there is a clear mistake, that we forgot the derivative fields. So, and this is where the conformal symmetry is going to come in. You see, it's okay to write this, it's okay to, it's important to realize that with every fluctuation A, with every field A, there are going to be, of course, fields which are just derivatives of A, right? And although these fields are not independent of A on the level of the two-point function, so of course if I know the two-point function of A, then I can just differentiate it and I can compute the two-point function of the gradient of A and so on. But I should not forget that I should include these derivative fields plus derivatives also in the right-hand side of the algebra. And if I don't include these derivatives, then I'm not going to get a sensible expression for the three-point function. So this derivatives inclusion is completely, is very, very important. Except that here I'm in a fix, because, you know, if I were to include these derivatives, I have to tell, I have to, you know, with what kind of coefficients can I include them? In principle, if you just look at this algebra, it looks like I should include them with independent coefficients. Right? There is nothing about this algebra which tells that the coefficient of the derivative field is proportional to the coefficient of the field itself. And I could do it, but then I would get too many variables to work with. Because now my variables are the scaling dimensions delta I, all these three-point function coefficients fi, jk, and also the same coefficients for the derivative fields. There are just too many variables to work with. And in this form, this has never been done. And so here, finally, we come to this notion of conformal invariance. And as you see, this conformal invariance will allow us to drastically reduce the number of variables and get some quantitative results. So what's this conformal invariance? So I started this whole thing talking about randomization group. And I talked about fixed points of randomization group transformation and that these fixed points should describe the critical states of matter. And, you know, since the randomization group, how I introduced it, it was based on this block spin transformation. It tells you that physics at the critical point should be scale invariant, right? So the randomization group tells you that physics should be invariant under the transformation x going to lambda x. And indeed, that's how we implemented it here. So this two-point function just rescales, three-point function relation remains invariant. So we implemented this scale invariance. It's now built in into our language that we are trying to build. But now, so another thing which I forgot to say, but it was kind of implicit, is that rotational invariance, which is broken by the lattice explicitly, it is recovered at long distances. Right here, I was writing my all my equations as if there was rotational invariance at long distances, and I did not explain. So this has also this fact that rotational invariance is recovered also has a natural and simple explanation in the language of randomization group, but I don't have time to explain it. But let me just write it. So plus rotational invariance. Okay. So now what is then the conformal transformation? So the conformal transformation it's going to be a function of the form, it's going to be a transformation of the form x prime equals f of x, which has the property that locally it looks like dilatation plus a rotation. So locally, and I'm going to explain it in the picture in a second, so locally it looks like dilatation plus rotation. So what it means is that let's take our space and let's consider a certain grid of points or of lines in our space. So if you take this grid and if you apply the conformal transformation, a conformal transformation, then this grid, every line, so the lines in the grid after this transformation, they remain orthogonal to each other. So you get something like that. So they intersect still at a 90 degree angle, but the size of these cells, which was uniform in the first grid, it no longer has to be uniform after the transformation. So there is a certain local dilatation factor, lambda of x, which is an non-trivial function of x. Right? So that's what we call a conformal transformation. Now you might think that there are tons of such transformations and you might think that there are lots and lots of such transformations, but actually it's not true. So even though this looks pretty generic, there are actually very few additional such transformations that you get. So, and this is a theorem which was proved by Liouville in 1850, who proved that if the dimension is larger than or equal to 3, then in fact, in addition to dilatations, rotations, and translations, which are, of course, trivially conformal, you get just one new transformation. You get inversion, which maps x mu into x mu over x squared. So it maps origin to infinity, infinity to the origin, and so on. So this is the only new transformation that you get. And of course, you can generate new transformations by applying inversion together with translations and rotations and dilatations, but these are just compositions. So clearly these conformal transformations form a group. And so this is the only new element that you have to add to the group to generate everything else. So this is a surprising result, and it's all the more surprising because if you are in two dimensions, then actually this result is not true. So in two dimensions, you get many more conformal transformations, and in fact, any analytic mapping, so if you take a two-dimensional plane, use holomorphic coordinates, then any holomorphic mapping Z going to F of Z is going to give you a conformal transformation. But today, I would like to focus on the three-dimensional case. Right. Okay, and so why is this conformal transformation of any relevance to our story? Well, because what I would like to now argue is that under certain plausible assumptions, you can expect that the fixed point is going to be not only scale invariant, but also conformally invariant. So let me explain how it works. So I will start again. So this is the claim that I would like to defend here, that fixed point of randomization group transformation can be expected to be conformally invariant. And so the argument proceeds entirely by drawings. So I can hope to finish it in the 5-10 minutes that I have. So let me start with this lattice. So let's suppose that this is the lattice of the easing model. And let's suppose that I'm interested in measuring a correlation function, a three-point correlation function of these three points. This one, and this one. Right. Now I'm going to take this lattice and I'm going to apply to it a conformal transformation. But now I'm going to draw it just on top of this lattice. So I'm going to have this, and then I kind of have this, and now I'm going to have kind of this, something like that. And now, so this drawing is just a template for what I have to do next. So the next thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to apply my randomization group block spin transformation, not uniformly on my original lattice, but I'm going to now unite all spins which happen to fall into this green grid, non-uniform grid. So I'm going to do a non-uniform randomization group transformation. So for example, I'm going to take all these spins in this big block, and I'm going to unite them. This I'm going to unite them, and so on. So this is going to be a very different type of transformation that I had before. But I would like to argue. So first of all, the first thing which is obvious is that if I do it, then this transformation, so once I shrink, so what it means is that I'm going to, so right now all these blocks, they have different sizes, but once I shrink them to one point, they all become of the same size. And it means that after the transformation, the distance between this point is going to be rescaled by a different factor than, say, the distance between this point and this point. It's no longer a homogeneous rescaling of distances, but it's some complicated change of distances, right? That's one thing to realize. And the second thing that, and here I'm going to use something which I mentioned before, is that, as I said before, there is evidence that these fixed point Hamiltonians, fixed point energy functionals, which are very, very complicated and unknown, they retain a certain degree of locality. They are not completely crazy unlocal things. And if that's the case, then I can expect that they remain invariant not only under such uniform rescaling of distances, but also under locally uniform rescaling of distances. And here it's crucial that this functional should be somewhat local. So if that's true, if my energy function remains invariant under this non-uniform, locally uniform rescaling of distances, then what I can prove is that my original three-point function inserted here, here, and here becomes related to a different three-point function where these two distances rescale in a different way. And say they become here, here, and maybe here. So it's a different, it's a triangle with a completely different aspect ratio. Right? So it becomes related, not identical, because once I do this transformation, I also have to rescale the operator. So let me write down the equation that I'm going to get. So I'm getting the following equation, that a1 of x1 prime, a2 of x2 prime, and so on, is equal to 1 over lambda of x1 to the power delta 1, lambda of x2 to the power delta 2, and so on, times a1 of x1, a2 of x2, and so on. Right? So you see, I get formally looking the same equation as for scale invariance, but with rescaling factors here which depend on x1 and x2, and so on. Right? Okay, so how much time I still have? I think I started like not earlier than 22 minutes. Because you spoke at the beginning of my presentation. Okay, great. Yeah, no, but I'm actually going to finish. Yeah. Now the point is that, you know, what's going to happen now is that if I impose this conformal invariance, it turns out that all these derivatives, they no longer enter with independent coefficients, but they enter with coefficients which are proportional to the coefficient of the first field, right? So there is a dramatic reduction of the number of degrees of freedom, of the number of unknowns. And now what you do is that, so here was the problem that the three-point function was depending on the order in which I was applying the algebra. So this three-point function becomes independent of the order in which you apply the algebra. But then if you go to the four-point function level, it's not manifestly independent. So you can now impose, so now the equation that you would like to impose is that the four-point function at the end of the day should be independent of the algebra. And this becomes an equation on all these numbers, on delta I and Fijk. So that's how you approach the problem in this language. And now, so the beauty of this language is that you don't have to deal with any divergent power series and so on. Everything is mathematically convergent. And so I was going to give some numbers at the end of the day, which show you that using this method, you can compute the critical exponent of the 3D Ising model better than all the previous techniques, but I think I'll skip these details because I don't have time. So so let me just summarize. So I presented three methods in the theory of critical phenomena. One is renormalization group, or real space renormalization group. Another, which was this perturbation theory in continuum perturbation theory, which was divergent. And the finite method was what this new language that I presented here, and which is called bootstrap, or conformal bootstrap. And what transpires is that with this bootstrap, not only does it give you a new conceptual way of viewing things, but also, which is very important for me personally, is that it actually allows to compute things more precisely than the previous approaches. So I would argue that that's going to be the method for the future.
Do you know that it gives the same Ising exponents that you get from that, the other kind of stuff?
No, it definitely agrees with the other methods. So in the sense that other methods give you certain error bars,
yeah,
or these error bars, and our method like sits inside the error bar.
But you can't prove that.
But it's always like that with the conformal symmetry techniques. For example, in two dimensions, where using additional tricks that you use in two dimensions, you can solve the bootstrap equations not just approximately, but you can solve them exactly. So once you solve them exactly, you know you have a consistent theory which tells you exact values of critical exponents. Now you go back to numerics and say, ah, but my exponents agree to so many digits and so on. But there is universality. So if you nailed a couple of critical exponents, then chances are that you actually nailed the theory.
I'm asking is you have a theory of what? You see what I mean?
It's a theory for the critical state of matter, which classifies you all possible critical states. But now it has to be determined by an independent means what is the microscopic origin of this critical state. But this can be done on the basis of just a handful of critical exponents, in the same way as it is done in two-dimensional case.
Sorry? Question.
When you said that fixed point Hamiltonian is almost local, can you make it just slightly more precise when you said it's not fully local but almost local? Can you make it just as an example? Or?
Yeah. Well. So. So. Basically, there are two. What. If you do these experiments with the lattice RG, then what you notice is that these off-diagonal couplings, they decay faster than 1 over R to some pretty high power.
And that number is on.
And this power is actually important, that it should be larger than a certain power when you cross over to the non-local Ising model, long-range Ising model critical behavior. Because they exist in critical behavior, which is long range and long. But in the language of field theory, there is another litmus test for the locality of the critical point, which is the existence of the stress tensor operator. So if your critical point has a spin 2 conserved current operator, then that's what we mean by the critical point being local.
I had a question. You said error bars within, I don't know, 5-loop, 7-loop error bars.
Yeah.
Where do the error bars come from in your approach? And in perturbative approach, you know, it's a matter of the Petty resummation business and so on, but in your approach, where, how do you estimate error bars?
Well, in my approach, they come from, so this system, of course, it's a system of infinitely many equations for infinitely many unknowns, right? So you have to truncate the system in to make it tractable. You have to truncate throwing out a certain amount of information. So you remain with a smaller system. Now, what you observe is that as you compute, put more and more information in, then you see that the answers that you get, they monotonically converge, which is unlike in this other example. So the beauty of this method is that at every step of the computation, you get a rigorous bound, but you see that this bound converges.
Okay. Now, as you said, you know, the error bars that are now published are between best Monte Carlo and best whatever, 7-loop, 6-loop. They're disjoint.
In the easy model case, I think they are not. There is not so much difference, but maybe 2 or 2.5 sigma difference. But there is a case when there is a model.
They do not overlap
difference.
Anymore. So
sir?
They do not overlap anymore. You know, if you read the offers, of course. But
2.5 sigma, I would say, is okay.
Yeah, but my question is.
But our answer agrees with Monte Carlo.
Okay, good.
No, but there is a case where they, in the case of the liquid helium. Field theory, so Monte Carlo and experiment disagree by 8 sigma, and in that case we don't have an answer yet.
So I'm involved in the so-called NPRG approach to this,
uh-huh.
And you know we can discuss convergence issues.
Okay.
The best numbers we have also sit in the Monte Carlo error bars and not in the 5-7
uh-huh. Uh-huh. Okay, I'll be happy to discuss.
All right, thanks a lot.